This evening is the last talk in a series of talks I've been giving on the precepts, the five lay precepts. Can people hear okay who are using the one who's working today? Okay. And in the classic presentation of Buddhist practice, it begins with the practice of ethics. And ethics is much more than just the precepts. It also includes the practice of generosity and right speech and a variety of ethical things. But the precepts are right in the center of the ethical life in Buddhism. And that one wouldn't practice meditation until one is well established ethically. Here in the West, we have this often upside down, where many people in the West, when they begin Buddhist practice, they start with meditation. And then what often happens is after some time of practicing meditation, sometimes it's, you know, it could be anything, you know, short term, long term, depending on people's how meditation unfolds. People get interested in how they live their lives. They want to find some way to live their lives that's in harmony with the sense of integrity, the sense of harmony, the sense of well-being, the sense of freedom, the sense of something, compassion, that arises from meditation practice. And so then people get interested, how do I live my life so that my life is not just a foundation for meditation practice, this helps my meditation, but my daily life actually is an expression of what I'm realizing and understanding in daily life. And at this point, some people in the West have become interested in ethics and the precepts. And sometimes not so much as foundations, again, for practice, but rather as a way of helping them express the freedom, the sense of well-being they found inside. And some people use the precepts then as guidelines, because with the idea that when you're about to break a precept, it's not necessarily that you're bad or wrong, but that when you're about to break them, it's probably a very good time to stop and look and see what's really going on here. Chances are that when you break a precept, you've somehow lost touch with that sense of place of integrity that you've touched in meditation. And so maybe it's important then to reestablish that connection to the place of integrity. If you're harried or upset or angry and you want to do something that breaks the precept, wrong speech or stealing or any of them, then stop and look and reestablish that connection if you feel like you lost it. So there are some people who are quite content with this way, that you start with meditation and eventually you get the precepts. And there are some people who are horrified in the Buddhist world that you would teach meditation without first teaching ethics. But as I tell people who are horrified, if I offered right now I'm doing an ending, this is the last week of a 5-week class also on mindfulness meditation, intro class I do. And we have some 60, 70 people who've come every week to this class. I think it's quite remarkable. So many people will come. But then, but if I had advertised that we were doing a 5-week class introduction to ethics, well, people would have come. But I don't know if we had that many people. We had that many people here tonight. So I don't know. Many of you knew we were doing this series. But I think many of you who knew also were going to come anyway. You're kind of a captured audience, right? You're coming. Whatever he talks about is okay. So today's the last day, and we're talking about the precept of no intoxication, which is a very interesting one. And I'll say a little bit about the technical or the legalistic aspects of the precept, because it's kind of interesting. And that is that the wording of the precept is to refrain. Actually, say it this way. The Pali, the original Buddhist language, where this is laid out, the original grammar is ambiguous about what it means. So there's a loophole, right? So whenever there's a loophole in ethics, we like that. Or we don't. But so the ambiguity is, does the grammar say, I will refrain from intoxicating drinks and drugs? Or does it say, I will refrain from intoxicating myself with drinks and alcohol, with alcohol and drugs? So the difference is that in the second way, you might still partake in alcohol and drugs, but not to the point of getting intoxicated. So mostly that means, like, you know, social drinking. You know, you can drink a little, you know, glass of wine, and you don't even get tipsy. You know, just kind of a nice thing, and it's a nice social thing, and you know, it doesn't seem to, you know, bother anything you've been doing for 30 years. It doesn't bother you or anybody. Nothing changes. And so, what does the precept say? Does it say absolutely no alcohol, or no alcohol to the point of intoxication? You'll find different Buddhist teachers will have very strong opinions about which side of this divide they see the grammar. And actually, the people who have the strongest opinions tend to be the ones who say the grammar says absolutely no drinks, no alcoholic drinks. The people who say, you know, well, you know, as long as you don't get intoxicated, they don't seem to have strong opinions about, you know, this, you know, whatever. If you're a monastic, a Buddhist monk or nun, then the explanations of this, or the wording of it, is much less ambiguous. There it says that you're not allowed to have any more alcohol. You're not allowed to have even the amount of alcohol that would fit on the tip of a blade of grass. If it's less than that, maybe it's okay. However, there are exceptions for medicinal purposes. Some medicines are prepared with alcohol, and the monastics are allowed in that case to use it. So the other interesting thing about this precept about alcohol is that, as we know, there's five lay precepts commonly, as has come down to us. In the teachings of the Buddha, there's a lot of discussion about ethics and about precepts. However, in many places, it's the first four precepts that get discussion. Sometimes all five precepts are discussed and presented, but often only the first four are presented. In the classic description of right action and right action in the Eightfold Path, it's the first four precepts which are mentioned, not the fifth. So a number of places, it's the first four which are considered really important or talked about. The fifth gets kind of like, it's kind of sometimes not included, sometimes included. There's some kind of ambiguity or some kind of difference between the fifth precept and the other four. And one difference, perhaps, is that the first four precepts, killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, and lying, can be seen as involving other people, and generally harming other people. Whereas it could be said that alcohol, if you do it, you know, if you lock yourself in your house and don't leave alone, that chances are that it's just something very personal, doesn't really affect other people. And so it's not interpersonal in the way that the other four are. So it doesn't cause interpersonal harm automatically. You could, in theory, drink alcohol and not cause harm. So there's some difference there with the precepts. So this an issue of the interpersonal world becomes important. And so part of the reason for following the five precepts, or the four precepts, is not just for your own sake, but also out of compassion and care for your friends and neighbors and family and the world around you, that you don't want to cause harm. So then, we don't have to think very, very long before we realize that alcohol and drugs in our society creates a tremendous amount of harm in our society. A tremendous amount. And my guess is that the greatest percentage of people who are incarcerated in the United States prisons are there because of drugs. Is that someone might know here? Is that probably right? Is that right? And two monk stories. There were two monks who were walking down the path, and one of the monks said, "This spot here would be a good place for a temple." And the second monk plucks up a blade of grass and sticks it into the ground and says, "The temple is built." And so one way of understanding the story is that every place, wherever you are, that's a good place to build a temple. Wherever you are. Wherever you go, there you are, right? Wherever you are, that's the place where you create a sacred space. So you could think it's saying, well, wherever you are, that's where heaven is found. That's where paradise is found. That's where the kingdom of God is found. That's where, you know, the enlightened experience, what's sacred, is found. But usually the way the story is understood is a little bit different than that. It's not that the place itself, independent of you, is sacred, but an action on your part makes the place you're at sacred. So the monk plucks a blade of grass and sticks it in the ground, says a temple is made. So we have to do something in order to make the place we're at sacred. We contribute to it. And now you could, you know, go collect lots of bricks and build a big cathedral, make a big temple. But that's not, you know, as interesting as what really makes, in Buddhism, what makes each place we are in, each moment, each situation sacred, is the quality of our attention or awareness, the mindfulness we bring, the care we bring to the situation. There's something that's so important in attention itself that it has the nature of being, that creates a situation into some kind of sacred dimension. So what is it in awareness that makes it sacred? Some of you have the experience of having been seen or met with someone else, have a real sense of presence, or maybe just being in a place and feel very, very present, fully present. Future and past kind of fade away, and the present moment feels timeless. But for that timeless presence to be here, there has to be awareness. To really see someone or be seen takes presence, takes awareness. Somehow the awareness is what makes things sacred and special. Even in situations where things are not going right, or so-called, when things are not going well, when we're suffering, there is some way of meeting our suffering, meeting the suffering of the world, with kind of presence, with awareness, that Buddhism would say makes it somewhat sacred. So we have to contribute to the sacredness. If we sit back and just kind of think, well, you know, I just, you know, life is sacred, it's really great, and I'll just sit in my easy chair and enjoy it, chances are that you're not contributing to making this world sacred. But it's the meeting with our awareness which does it. That's the first story. The second monastic story is the story of a monk who was dared, or was required. There's different versions of the story. One is when he was dared, and he took up the dare. But another one was that somehow he was kidnapped and held at knife point, or threatened, say, "We're going to do some horrible thing to somebody unless you break one of the precepts." So either you dare them, break one of the precepts, one of the five precepts, or you have to, otherwise something terrible is going to happen. So the monk reflects about the precepts. And he says, "Well, I don't want to kill anybody. I don't want to steal from anybody. I don't want to engage in sexual misconduct with anybody. I don't want to lie, because all those have to do with other people and cause bad karma for other people, perhaps. But I can get drunk, because, you know, that's just myself. I do it on my own, and, you know, I'm not really going to affect anybody. So he figured, okay, that's what I'll do. So he goes and gets drunk. Once he's drunk, he breaks all four of the other precepts. So there's a tendency among some people when they get drunk, or tipsy even, to begin losing a certain degree of control or clarity about their actions and their behavior. Certain kind of healthy inhibition sometimes is let go of, and people do things which later they wish they had never done. So there are, you know, two maybe categories of drinking alcohol or taking drugs. One is light social drinking or light drinking, and the other is actually drinking to the point of becoming intoxicated or becoming an alcoholic. And both of them have their rationale for doing them. Both of them have the reason why you're motivated to do it, and both of them, I think, could use some investigation, some understanding of what's going on there. And some of them have the same root. One route for drinking, and sometimes it's said as being one of the most important motivations for drinking alcohol for a lot of people, especially alcoholics, is they feel some degree of disharmony. They feel lonely, they feel afraid, they feel somehow depressed or upset, or something feels off with them. They feel down in some way. And alcohol is the vehicle, or drugs can be a vehicle, for somehow feeling they reestablish harmony, reestablish a sense of well-being or pleasure, or lift themselves out of that funk. I know some people who will drink alcohol just a little bit before they go to the party. Because when you get to the party, you're supposed to be kind of vivacious, and the flow of the conversation is supposed to be smooth, you're supposed to be kind of buoyant and happy, and just a little bit of alcohol kind of takes that little edge off your shyness or inhibition, and or your something, and you can just, you know, you can kind of be much more fun to be with when you drink. So there's some feeling that how we are at the moment is not okay. We're not willing to sit with it or be with it. We want to fix it or change it for something we think is better. So from a point of view of practice, of making this moment sacred, there's a lost opportunity. And the lost opportunity is to somehow meet our life and our pain with compassionate awareness, with careful attention. And in meeting with careful attention, create something very different for ourselves. Find our freedom, find a presence, find something. Find love, find compassion, something, by offering ourselves that kind of care. When we turn away from that by drinking and trying to fix the problem by drink, we lose this very important opportunity. And I would argue that when we're trying to fix ourselves by drinking, we're actually moving in the opposite direction from the solution. It's maybe relief, but it's not release. It's maybe pleasure, but it's not leading to happiness. It's maybe, you know, it doesn't really take us in the direction that someone who is engaged in a spiritual practice wants to go. Someone wants to go the practice of waking up, it's taking them in the wrong direction. So, I think in looking at this precept of no intoxication, each person is going to have to decide, each lay person is going to have to decide for themselves whether it's no alcohol at all, or whether it's, you know, just a little bit, like once every year having a glass of wine or something very light, or whether it's just, you know, every day it's a, you know, just a little bit less than the tip of a glass, blade of glass, you know. And you know, to decide for ourselves. But I think that in deciding for ourselves, it's very important to look at what motivates drinking. To really be honest about it. And then ask the question, does this really serve your best interest? Is there a better way? Alcohol sometimes is a quick way, quick fix, or drugs to change things. But is it really, in the long term, going to make things better? What I hope is that people who do a meditation practice, do mindfulness practice, sooner or later begin learning a capacity for cultivating a sense of well-being that is independent of drugs, alcohol, and not only that, but any of the conditions of their life. That no matter what the conditions of their life is like, they have the capacity to tune in and find a place of being settled, calm, peaceful, and to some degree a sense of well-being. And that becomes their resource if there's some problem. The advantage of that is by turning inward, sometimes then we have to deal with what is going on there. We're not bypassing it, our pain, our suffering, our fear, our hostility, or whatever's going on there. But you have to actually face it and try to work with it and settle it. So that becomes the solution. That becomes the way of working with disharmony, with loneliness, whatever is going on. Is it, if I have the capacity to go in. And that becomes, hopefully, a resource that becomes easier and easier to tap into. It's not something you have to kind of go and meditate for an hour to do, or meditate for a whole day to do. It becomes something that maybe even just two or three breaths, or just kind of remembering, let me wake up here. I've forgotten to be present. Let me be present here, and in that presence, find something that's very satisfying. I find that presence or mindfulness is very satisfying. This is a very strange thing. I find it very satisfying, or I said, there's some kind of very deep satisfaction in being present in situations where someone is suffering greatly. If I'm with someone who has some horrible suffering, and I don't want them to have the suffering, or I'm suffering, and it doesn't seem like I don't want it, I'd like to help them in some way. And it's, you know, in some ways not, shouldn't be that they're suffering this way. But the fact that they're suffering, given that they're suffering, there's something satisfying about being awake and present for that. That's very different than it is fretting over it or worrying about it or trying to run away from it or escape it or all the other ways we can relate to pain. There's something very satisfying about being awake to it. And if we learn how that satisfaction of being awake to pain, then a lot of the motivation for drinking or drugs, I think, falls away for many people. Some people could say, well, I don't drink because of pain. I don't drink because I feel harmonious with my world. It's just pleasure. It's like, you know, some people go for a massage, some people go for a walk. You know, I just, you know, get this really good wine, and Gallo wine or something. And you know, it's just so sweet. And it's so nice. And or some people say, well, I do it socially to just be kind of, you know, get along. And I do know what's very common with alcohol, I think you all know, is the phenomenon of denial. That people sometimes don't really look honestly at what's really going on. Another thing about alcohol, though, and this is kind of begins broaching the interpersonal dimension, is that alcohol is not something we only do personally. It's something that generally we don't do it locked up in our rooms and with no effect on others. Our behavior affects the world around us. Generally, people don't make their own alcohol. Some people do, but you know, you buy into a whole alcohol or drug industry, which is not necessarily the most, I don't know what to say, but say it this way. One of the clearest ethical, kind of strong lines that the Buddha put about lay ethical behavior was, he said, a lay person should absolutely not engage in the commerce of alcohol. Should you drink, or should you drink to the point of intoxication, or not drink at all? It's a little ambiguous. How should you do that? But no commerce. You don't be involved in the sale or the production of alcohol. Same thing with weapons. No involvement in commerce or production of weapons or of poisons. And the other one is not involved in the commerce of people. So slaves and prostitutes, and things like that. So these things are completely off bounds for Buddhists. If you want unambiguous Buddhist standards, and these are unambiguous. So, in buying alcohol, we buy into this huge industry. And then also, people are watching us. People, take their cues from us. See what we're doing. What we do, and subtly reinforces what other people do, subtly or greatly. And I first saw this very clearly when I was living at the San Francisco Zen Center, where a lot of the Zen students I knew there did not refrain from alcohol. Mm-hmm. But they were not allowed to have alcohol at the Zen Center. The temple was a place where there was no alcohol allowed. And it was a very important place because it was a refuge for people who were struggling with alcohol and drugs. And there are a lot of people who are struggling. About 5-6 years ago, someone who came regularly to Monday night said, Gil, you need to give a talk about recovery or alcohol or something, because you wouldn't know this, because you don't go to AA meetings or recovery meetings. But there's a lot of people who come to Monday night who go to recovery meetings. So, I don't know if that's still true. I could have a show of hands if you... maybe I shouldn't ask. I lost my train of thought. Even not taking alcohol, you can lose your clarity. So how we affect other people. So the temple is, the Zen Center was a place that was a refuge for people who were struggling. It was very helpful for them to know there was a place they could come. And there were some times that the behavior of people at the Zen Center was not exemplary, some of the priests and the teachers. There was one time in particular where one of the most senior teachers there did basically an ethical transgression, not with alcohol. What was very instructive to me, that was some of the people who were alcoholics were struggling with that issue. They needed to have a place, a refuge, where they could really felt they could rely on the people there being somehow ethically upright. And when the senior teacher was not ethically upright, they felt really shaky. Their ground, their refuge, their kind of life support was kind of taken away from them. So I think it's a great gift to our society to offer places that are refuges from alcohol and drugs for people who are struggling. So I feel very strongly that our building here should be a place that's alcohol-free, because it's an offering, it's a gift to people. So when we have potlucks, for example, not to have wine here, or alcohol, or drugs for the potluck. and then also individual people can live that way. Individuals can live their life so it's a gift to people who need that extra support. And so when they know they come to your house, they know they're not going to be tempted or feel awkward because everyone else is drinking and they're not going to drink. Or just the fact that maybe you're the only other person at the party who's not drinking, and that person who's struggling with their alcoholism sees, let me just stand near you. It's really helpful for me to know that someone else is that way so that it's easier for me. I think it's a great gift. So that's another motivation for this precept, is it's a gift to our society. And I would argue that none of you, of course, but maybe I shouldn't say it that way, but our society in general is in desperate need of people who are going to offer that gift. Desperately. It's phenomenal. It's just astounding the degree to which people in this country are struggling and suffering and causing harm through alcohol and drugs. And so whatever we can do to help that, I think, is a step in the right direction. So those are my thoughts. So what do you think? If you want to ask any questions or raise any issues or criticisms or reservations?
I'm curious about
some religion that I heard or read about requiring certain kind of mind-altering substance. Why?
Yeah, there are some. There's many religions that include alcohol or drugs as part of their thing. In Catholic communion on Sunday morning, they drink a little bit. I have no idea how much they drink. I think it's very little. It can't, like a sip. You know, it's pretty light. And so, you know, like the monks are allowed to have alcohol as medicine, so I think communion is... but I've heard that... anyway. And then there's the Native American in religions or certain religions where they take psychotropic drugs. And they do that as part of their spiritual practice. And it's usually done in a controlled way. So usually, ideally, there'd be an elder there, or you have guidance, and there's a way in which it's done. And so some people, I know some people feel, well, that's not breaking the precept because it's not for the purpose of intoxication. And in the controlled setting or doing it, I'm not about to break the other precepts. It's really for the purpose of entering some kind of spiritual dimension or it's a spiritual practice. And so some people feel that way. And some people it's their practice, and I don't think that there's any basis. I don't know what more to say. Yes.
I heard. I heard a talk by Thich Nhat Hanh a long time ago that was that impressed me very much because people were coming to him with this question as well. And it seems to me, if I remember this correctly, was that he suggested that you not engage in this activity where other people who are not also engaging in this activity are present, and that you particularly refrain when children are present because you have an influence over them whether you realize it or not. And he was suggesting, for example, that people drink in houses, not in public places.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed to be an interesting compromise. Mm-hmm. I'm not exactly sure how I feel about it, but it was certainly an interesting one.
It's an interesting idea. And one way of looking at that kind of behavior, refraining drinking in public or in front of children, is thinking of it as a gift. It's an act of generosity rather than some moralistic thing. Yes? We like to use the mic, so if you can wait for it. But thank you. There's some people who can't hear otherwise.
I remember reading Thich Nhat Hanh's precept on this, and he included other things too, like bad TV shows.
Oh, yeah. Mm, yeah, it's common enough for people to extend this precept to anything that intoxicates the mind or is toxic for the mind or anything which, certain kind of, there's a lot of things which we lose our clarity, lose our common sense, we get intoxicated. Certainly television can do that at times and a lot of things. So politics can do it for some people. In the back.
alcohol, maybe other things too. But there was one stage where you started looking forward to the time when you could have a drink. And you're projecting forward and you're anticipating and desiring that. But it's just saying, oh, at 5 o'clock I can have a drink. And that was one of the indications that it's gotten too far.
Mm-hmm.
I just remember that as, as a clue, which might also be desire. I mean, like that thing in that whole area.
Yeah. I think that people who meditate start getting very sensitive or have a different perspective on addiction, because we realize how powerful and pervasive the addictive tendencies can be in human beings, because you know, we're addicted to our thinking. You know, you sit and try to meditate and not think in sense, and you know, you realize, you know, not simply that thinking comes back over and over again, but there's this tremendous drive and addiction, and you know. And addiction is it's to the point where it's actually quite frightening for some people to give up their thinking. So then we begin understanding how desire drives us. Right, up here in the front now.
I was wondering about intoxicate. How about with caffeine? That's so pervasive in the society, and I've studied, played with this on myself. I think I'm drinking it, one, because I really am addicted to Pete's. but if I find if I go to some place where the coffee is not, if it's not good coffee or there's not really good tea, I don't have any, I prefer just to drink water. So then I've got more on the desire side than the effect side. Like I always thought when I was in school, I was drinking coffee just because it gave me something to do, because if I had to hold a cup, I couldn't fall asleep because I'd pour the coffee in my lap. It wasn't the effect of the caffeine. But where does that play in?
So generally, except like with Thich Nhat Hanh at times, generally in the Theravada and Buddhist tradition, or in Buddhist tradition in general, that the fifth precept does not extend itself to things like caffeine and tobacco. And you could argue that there's a kind of a, you know, generally caffeine doesn't make you less clear-headed. Sometimes it makes you more clear-headed, you know, if you're sleeping or something. And so it's usually not extended to that. So it's not an ethical issue. But it might be both you know, addiction to coffee or an addiction to caffeine or addiction to tobacco, for example, might be a spiritual issue, in that it has to do with how free you are, the freedom in your heart, freedom in your mind. And if I remember my father telling me when I was about, I don't know, maybe 8 or something like that, is when he stopped smoking cigarettes. And he said that he found himself out of cigarettes at midnight, and found himself walking to the neighborhood store. When he got to the store, he said, "This is ridiculous." And then he just stopped smoking from that day on, from that, because he thought it was so ridiculous. So it's not a spirit, not an ethical issue, but it might be a spiritual issue or a liberation issue. So I saw someone. He wants. Yes.
I'm just curious about how this fits with the recent research showing that alcoholism is a disease.
Alcoholism is a disease.
It is a disease, a neurological chemical disease.
The it fits fine. What do you think? It doesn't fit.
I mean,
tell me more. What's your concern?
Maybe I'm missing, you know, basic, you know, Buddhism 101. But I think what I hear you talking a lot about is the motivation and the watching, and you know, when I stopped smoking, it was very much that decision.
Yeah.
To stop out of an awareness and cultivation. However, I have family members who are long-term addicts, alcoholics.
Right.
And
it's not that's so easy.
It's a different process if it's a physical disease that they have, that they're working with. Is it not different?
Well, I mean, it's different. Sure, it's different. I mean, what's driving it is different. But I think that, and so what we found, you know, like with recovery, with AA, is that it's very hard to do a recovery work alone. So when people have this kind of, as a disease, for example, there's a whole way of understanding how to relate to that. And so some people it's very helpful to realize they have a disease because they feel like they're out of control. So something else is, that's what's the first step in AA, you know, to realize that, what does it say? What? No, what? One person, yes? What's the first step?
We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable.
Yeah. So that's a little bit similar to saying I got something like a disease, something's I can't control or deal with, and then you begin looking for other resources, some power that's greater than yourself and various things, and. So in Buddhism, one of the powers that's greater than ourselves is our awareness. We don't take our awareness that personally. I think it's it's a power bigger than the ego, for example. And so, people, if it's the level of being an addiction like a disease, it's very important to realize you can't do it alone. And so it's often you need to find a group of people to be with, or a community, or get some kind of support for that work. And sometimes people go into addiction programs, and even get residential programs to work with it because it's so powerful and they need a lot of support. And so this idea of our behavior being a gift to people, to other people, it is really hard for people to refrain. And so to be in an environment where that's supported is really helpful. And so our behavior can be a gift. We refrain. So I don't know if that answered your question, but... I think that the skills of mindfulness are very helpful for any kind of. When alcoholism is a disease, even though it's something maybe biological that's going on, the skills of presence, of non-reactivity, compassion, and equanimity that come with mindfulness give you some way of stepping out of the force and the power of those drives. So the last thing I'll say is, some of you know the story about me, that when I was in my early 20s, I went to live on what's called the farm. It was a commune in Tennessee. When I was there, there were some 700-800 people who lived in this commune, hippie commune. And it kind of was a outgrowth of the psychedelic scene in San Francisco. They just transported themselves from Haight-Ashbury to rural Tennessee. At some point they got arrested, the leaders of the community, for marijuana or some kind of drugs, and the leaders of the community spent a year in jail, and they realized that they couldn't really do psychedelics anymore in Tennessee. So LSD in particular, so they said we can stop doing LSD. But LSD was such an LSD was their spiritual practice, one of their main spiritual practices they had, and so they had to find a substitute for this very powerful drug. And what they found it was as powerful as LSD is honesty. So, why don't you, try a good dose of honesty, and may your honesty be as powerful. May you find out how honesty can be used to be as powerful as LSD, which for some people was the door for opening up the whole spiritual dimension for them. And honesty is phenomenal. So, thank you.